In all ages, whatever the form and name of government, be it monarchy, republic, or democracy, an oligarchy rules behind the facade. And Roman history, republican or imperial, is the history of the governing class. The marshals, diplomats... Again. In all ages, whatever the form and name of government, be it monarchy, republic, or democracy... Again.
I can do this.
Yeah, I believe in you.
Thank you. In all ages, whatever the form and name of government, be it monarchy, republic, or democracy, an oligarchy lurks behind the facade. And Roman history, republican or imperial, is the history of the governing class. The marshals, diplomats, and financiers of the revolution may be discerned again in the Republic of Augustus as the ministers and agents of power, the same men, but in different garb. They are the government of the new state. And that is a quotation from Ronald Syme's The Roman Revolution, published in 1939, and it is what we want to talk about today.
Yeah, powerful stuff. We're both holding copies. My co-host is well-thumbed. Mine is as yet unopened, but...
Well, I mean, to be fair to you, I only suggested this topic a couple of days ago, so you've done very well to be holding
the
copy.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, you bought it, and that's an important moral step.
And this room is distressingly full of books I've bought and not read.
Yeah, so it's I appreciate that that's a meaningful thing for you to have done.
Yeah, it's among friends.
Yeah. Why did I want to talk about? Well, this is one of the books I had to read before I went to university to study classics. It's considered a classic amongst classics, as it were. And the reason it is considered a classic is because it basically proposes an entirely new way of approaching the fall of the Roman Republic and the birth of the Roman Empire. Now, don't worry, I'm not really intending to go super nerdy on Roman history.
It's a safe space.
Yeah, 99% space. It's more about the insights about government itself that I think that I wanted to discuss, and what truly is a government, where does power truly lie in any state, and questions like that.
I guess there's a long tradition of trying to learn lessons from the present from Roman examples. But before we start, can I ask why we're reading a book from 1939? It's a long time ago.
It is a long time ago. Obviously, classics has been studied for 2,000 years, and so 1939 is actually relatively recent in this particular academic tradition. I appreciate that not everyone shares that perspective. So why are we doing it from 1939? Well, obviously, 1939 is a resonant year in 20th century history, and I think that sometimes at resonant moments, certain published works are given more resonance by the context of their publishing.
Yeah.
And Syme's The Roman Revolution, obviously 1939 is a particularly resonant year for a work like that to be published. A reappraisal of what is truly happening in this tumultuous period of Roman politics. It's a way of reflecting on 20th century history that was the history that of the modern day for Syme that was happening around him. And it's very, very clear that the experiences of the 1920s and 30s have shaped the way that he's approaching Roman history. But it's allowed him to pierce or dig beneath the aggregated, what am I looking for? The accreted historiographical traditions of classics around this particular moment in Roman history. And prior to Syme, it's fair to say that there's a lot of credulity for Augustus's claims to be refounding an ordered state after a century of anarchy. But regardless, it tended to be approached in a fairly academic and theoretical way. You know, it's autocracy versus republicanism. It's liberty versus tyranny. It had been very much approached in these terms of political theory.
Yeah, quite abstract. Here you're saying that in 1939, the actual events made these people feel more like humans making decisions.
Yes.
Much more relatable.
Exactly.
And so just that little insight Although that change in context can mean that you can write a whole new history about something that, as you say, had been written about many times over the previous 2,000 years.
Exactly. By watching effectively the resolutions, the takeover of states that was happening in Europe in the 30s by essentially what Syme would have called factions or gangs, so the fascists or the communists. By watching this happen, he was able to then think about what happened in Rome 2,000 years ago in an entirely new way. And so it's a strange case of the present reappraising the past rather than the past reappraising the present. And it's fair to say that this reappraisal has been incredibly influential in the way that the change from republic to empire has been viewed by classicist ever since.
Actually, this kind of sucks.
Well, yeah, more in the sense of like, well, actually, taking a sort of moral stance on either side is a fool's errand. I think is more the vibe.
Yeah, I do find it interesting how the history of events changes over time. So some of my favourite history books are about the history of the history of a certain event. George Garnett wrote one on the Norman Conquest, like how that's been talked about, just after it happened, or 200 years later, or today. And there's another one by Chris Tierman about the Crusades, where at the time his contention is that no one thought about them as a single movement. It was just some wars far away. And then he sort of charts how that sort of coalesced into it being glorious and about God. Then under Romanticism, it became this romantic quest. And now, in the modern era, it's great shame.
And it's colonialism.
Yeah. And so this is quite an interesting version of that.
Yeah. And, it's... I think that what you've just said is a perfect way of thinking about what I think is a really fascinating thing about history, which is that history really is just a story that we tell about the past. And, we talk a lot about narrative, but history just is a narrative. And that narrative is a tool in both political and cultural discourse in the here and now. And that narrative will change according to the needs of the present. Now, obviously, history or historians will claim, and they will truly believe, and I'm not wholly cynical about this, that they are trying to get as close as possible to the truth of what actually happened in the past. However, I think that there needs to be an acknowledgement that the only way that we can come to an understanding of the past is by telling a story about it, and that stories always... sort of construct themselves by omission as well as choices about what to include. Because, of course, you could never tell the entire story.
Yeah, there's infinite data.
There's infinite data.
And you've got 200 pages.
Yes. So you have to choose, you have to omit.
Yeah. Yeah, the framing. It's what always upset me about... Do you ever come across HTML fiction?
No.
So in the sort of... Well, probably 20 years ago now... People realised that actually you could tell stories in non-linear fashion using HTML, so using the internet. So you have the story, but you've got various links you can click in to kind of learn a bit about something else. And you almost make your own way as an agent through this story, because you're flicking between these various different documents and narratives and stuff like that. And the idea was it would make fiction a lot more compelling, a lot more involving, because... you've actually got agency in the story you choose to tell.
Yeah. Like kind of choose your own adventure.
Exactly. And like choose your own adventure books, it's terrible.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that the actual framing of the narrative is probably the most important thing a storyteller's doing. What he's choosing to include and omit, the viewpoint he gives, like that is as integral to a good story as the story itself.
And it's not clear to me that history would be meaningful if it wasn't in this format. If you were to just attempt to transcribe the totality of facts and data of a particular time period, you're right. First of all, there's infinite data, so it's impossible. But second of all, it's not clear to me that would be history.
It's meaningless.
It's meaningless.
And most PhDs these days fall into this trap where they just go really deep on some minutiae. And like, who cares?
Because you have to take a point of view. There is no such thing as an objective viewpoint, I don't think, because even an objective viewpoint is a viewpoint, and that implies an angle.
Yeah, exactly. You're accepting that objectivity is important.
Yeah.
And that in itself
is... Yes, that in itself is a sort of an ethical standpoint. So, you know, I think that's something that's very interesting to think about, the extent to which history is just... is a story that we tell. As I say, I'm not wholly cynical about the idea that some history is better than other. I'm not a relativist here. I want to be clear about that. I'm not wholly a relativist. I think that it's possible to have good history and bad history.
Yeah.
history and worse, you know, history. But I think it's important to understand that it is a narrative at heart.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know how familiar listeners will be with the this particular bit of classical history.
I think you should give an overview.
Well,
your own narrative.
Yeah. So,
what's important about it?
Yeah, this is the story of basically Rome is a city state in Latium, which is in Italy, central Italy, west of the Apennines. They spoke Latin, which is the language of Latium, and they when Rome sort of first comes together as a city-state sort of about 700 BC. First of all, has kings. The kings are got rid of, and because they're unpopular. And in its place, they set up a res publica, which basically means the public thing. And this is where we get our word republic from. And so this is, in a sense, the first republic. I mean, very real sense, the first republic. Mm. And the point is that it's set up very much in opposition to the idea of monarchy. And so monarchy is a bad thing. It's in the DNA of the res publica that monarchy is bad. Anyway, that's fine for many, many hundreds of years because Rome is only ruling sort of its immediate hinterland. But as Rome starts to gain in power, it starts conquering more and more. It sort of unifies the Italian peninsula. It comes up against the Carthaginians in the Punic War. It's really at that point, once Carthage has been defeated off some crazy, and I mean crazy wars. I mean, the First Punic War, sea battles, biggest sea battles ever in Mediterranean history, and, you know, Second Punic War, elephants over the Alps, and all of that good stuff. The Roman state sort of fills the vacuum that's been left by Carthage and the collapse of the successor kingdoms in the east, successors to Alexander the Great, and it comes to control basically the whole Mediterranean basin. So there's 50 years between 200 BC and 146 BC where this happens. And it's an explosion of Roman power that astonished the ancients. Now, the problem is that when you have... In the ancient world, the fastest that information can travel is really the speed of a horse, certainly on land, and that's about 20 miles an hour. And that's if you have a lot of horses all lined up in a row. So when we think of Rome ruling, say, you know, Greece or Spain, it's not like Greece or Spain are being ruled from Rome.
Yeah.
That's impossible because any instruction would take months to get there, or at the very least, many weeks. So instead... the actual governing is being done by governors or generals, more frequently generals on the spot, who are in control of the armies that actually, you know, provide the force to do the controlling. Now, what this means is that you have men, i.e. one man, in control of an army who's in control of something that is the size of a modern European nation state. So, you know, the governor of Spain is effectively the king of Spain. And the governor of Macedonia is effectively the king of Macedonia.
Yeah.
They have similar power when they're in that province.
Yeah.
And they get used to that. And they become incredibly wealthy. Their soldiers are a long way from home. They're not, probably not Roman at this point. They're from Italy. So they don't really have strong ties to Rome, really, anyway. Certainly not the res publica. They become incredibly loyal to their general, who looks after them in terms of life, limb, wealth. And all of those things. And if they're a particularly inspiring leader and a good general, they can have fanatically loyal troops. And so this government that's been set up very much in opposition to monarchy suddenly finds itself nominally in control of a whole clutch of what are essentially kings. And when the central power in Rome, the Senate, tries to... control these kings and tries to play its usual politics with them, they they don't really play ball. And fundamentally, what you get is they refuse to play by the rules.
And what are you going to do about it?
By which they would lose, and they appeal to their armies, and you have a succession of devastating civil wars for basically 100 years, and we don't need to go into the fine details. The end of these, the end point of these civil wars is the final clash between the last men standing. And the last men standing are Gaius Julius Caesar Octavianus, so not the famous Gaius Julius Caesar, but his legal heir and adopted son, who is basically known to history as Octavian, later Augustus. And his rival is Marcus Antonius, and his wife, Cleopatra, the last pharaoh of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the final battle between those two that decides the fate of the empire. Decides the fate of Rome. And it's Octavianus who wins the Battle of Actium in 31 BC. And he, therefore, is left as the sole dynast, the last military leader, the last sort of putative king standing. And what he does is, because he is now king in all but name, but he is inheriting a culture and a system that is fanatically opposed to monarchy, to the extent that it assassinated his legal adopted father, Gaius Julius Caesar, because it suspected him of wanting the kingship. He has to find a way of being king without being king.
Yeah.
And so what he does is he founds this system called the Principate, he calls himself Princeps, which basically means sort of first among equals, basically. Top citizen. And he cloaks his power in republican names and republican forms, and he has an entire very sophisticated program of propaganda and messaging that is all about, I have restored the republic, I have restored liberty, and that is the definition of what is happening here. Whereas of course, really, this was all about him consolidating monarchical power, and that became clear when he died. And the power passed to his successor Tiberius. So that process of Octavian, later called Augustus, coming to power is generally thought of as the fall of the Roman Republic.
Yeah.
Even though he, of course, messaged it as the restoration of the Roman Republic, classicists see that as the foundation of the Roman Empire as opposed to the Republic. And then you have three or four centuries, depending on how you want to look at it, of imperial power in the West. And another sort of millennium after that of imperial power in the East. So that's in a nutshell the history, the historical period that we're dealing with.
Yeah. So that's what this book is covering.
Yeah, that's what this book is covering. Now, what Syme does, which is really, really interesting, is he doesn't look at this in terms of the theories of republicanism and tyranny and liberty and all of that kind of thing. Instead, he does basically the historical study of names. And he looks at who Octavian, who later becomes Augustus, I'm just going to call him Octavian now, who he knew, who he was interacting with, who were the actual named individuals through whom he exercised power and whom he interacted with. Because Syme's thesis is that every government is actually an oligarchy. It is a concrete set of individuals.
Yeah.
It's not an abstract thing. It is actually a group of individuals, almost always men.
Mm.
And the real decisions that are taken by a government do not happen through official forums.
Mm.
They're not recorded. They're done...
What's that?
Yeah. They are done in secret. They're done in secret council. Not in secret, maybe is a bit misleading, but they are done privately.
Yeah, informally.
And they're done in the interaction between these concrete, specific individuals.
And this is what we see in all the WhatsApp messages from the government.
Yeah, I mean, in today, absolutely. Yeah, now it is, of course, still everything's digitally recorded, but fundamentally. That is how
small
power
group
is
communicating formally.
Exactly. Yeah. So Syme's contention is that is how power is actually exercised, is how its policy is actually formulated. The real decisions of government are taken really by what is essentially a gang of actual individuals who have seized control of the state at the head of a wider faction of interests. And those interests almost always, he makes the case, relate to property, wealth, and the other vectors of power, armed force, basically. And that everything else is a sort of a... Everything else is merely a story that is told on top of this.
To give it legitimacy.
To give it legitimacy and respectability and prestige.
Yeah.
And, that, you know, that is obviously a very 1939 view of the world when you're looking at what's happened in Italy, what's happened in Russia, what's happened in Germany at that point.
It feels quite contemporary to me.
I mean, it does to me as well, which is why I thought it'd be interesting to talk about.
That's the way you're framing it, no doubt.
Yeah. So why does that feel contemporary to you?
Well, but I think because we now have so much evidence that decisions are made informally over WhatsApp. We've seen that over COVID. Decisions weren't made in the way that you would expect if you read about our political system. They weren't made by Commons. They weren't made by, you know, the civil service or the experts or, you know, the cabinet.
Yeah, not, but it's not by debating cabinets, is it?
No. It was made by, you know, four guys in a WhatsApp group under stress, in a hurry, trying to save their own backs and
It's what's happening in those kind of informal chance meeting in corridors. It's what's happening in those closed little rooms. Where it's like, oh, can I pop it to you for 5 seconds and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I mean, I had a fascinating example of a previous job where we had no hierarchy, officially. which obviously meant no formal hierarchy.
So you can rephrase that to where we claimed we had no hierarchy in an absurd manner.
Yeah, where there was no hierarchy denoted on an org chart. But yeah, there was absolutely a hierarchy, and it was far more rigid than I've seen anywhere else because it came down to an oligarchy. It was people who got on making informed decisions and making them happen in a way that wasn't even moderated by, you know, the formal structure.
Yeah.
So most companies, this is what happens. But you've got the formal structure as well, and so it can't quite be fully unleashed.
Yeah.
Here, you had it in its purest form.
Well, it's always the way, isn't it, with organisations that claim to be non-hierarchical, or, you know, we have a very flat culture, you know, or whatever. Then you think, oh, my God, that's a massive red flag.
Yeah.
So basically, you've given complete free rein to the sort of narcissistic sociopaths.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There'll be a ruling clique.
Yeah. Yeah, not a good idea. So I think it's it's very instructive for thinking about modernity. So that got me thinking about, well, what is the faction that is currently in control of British politics? And I think that's an instructive question to ask. Syme basically makes the claim that the Caesarian faction, so this is the followers of Julius Caesar and later Octavian, they were called populares. So populists. That's literally what they were called.
Yeah.
And they are representing the interests of the soldiery. They're representing the interests of aristocrats who have basically been excluded from the current ruling oligarchy, so dispossessed aristocrats, and the urban plebeians, and possibly the sort of the alienated but powerful municipal individuals in the rest of Italy. So in other words...
That's quite a broad basket.
It is, yes, but
and who does that exclude?
It excludes the basically those who held property and land. So those who are in favour of the established order and do not want a redistribution of property. So they want the current system to continue. So the establishment.
Okay, so... Yeah, your use of the word populism is pretty on point there.
Yeah, 100%. So you had the populares, who are represented by the sort of Caesarians, as it were, and then you have the self-identified optimates, the best men, or they sometimes call themselves the boni, the good men.
Nice.
And they are the men of property. They are the men who have a vested interest in the current state of affairs.
Yeah, so the ones who run the current institutions.
They're the ones who run the Senate. They are at the very top of the optimates. They are a concrete group of individuals in the Senate who guide policy, who have control of the organs of government and wield them in their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, and obviously with some resonant modern political words being thrown in there, populists and the establishment and so forth, and it's worth thinking about, well, what would Syme make of modern British politics, and, you know, which faction is in power? And I think it's worth thinking about that. What do you think? Which faction do you think is currently in power?
Yeah, interesting question. Obviously, we've just had an election, and I don't think the faction in power has changed as a result of that election.
I 100% agree with you. I think just as in ancient Rome, the elections... I think that if you were a fair-minded observer 1,000 years hence, looking back at British elections in the 21st century, you would say that while there was a popular vote, elections were basically the process by which the governing faction competed for power.
Yeah, chose its own leaders.
Amongst itself. Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't say that it's there is a genuine competition between opposing interest groups.
Yeah.
At the top level of government.
Yeah, I think who can represent that one set of interests most effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what interests do the two main parties of British politics, Labour and the Conservatives, what interests do they represent, do we think?
Well, not mine.
But I think not yours because of your particular... because of your particular personality, because of your particular ethical views, not necessarily because of your socioeconomic status. So let's wind it back there for a second. So I mean, to give you my thesis, I think that they are the representatives of the professional classes. That is the faction. So it's those who have a vested interest in the current bureaucracy and its proliferation through the system. They are the ones who own property and have an interest in that, the value of that property being maintained. And that is the faction.
Yeah. There's obviously no action being taken to change anything material about the status quo.
No.
It's clinging on to status quo at all costs. So, yeah.
It's an alliance of bureaucracy and property.
Yeah. I certainly agree with the bureaucracy bit. The country seems to be run for the benefit of the civil service. But yeah, you're right, there's a wider point about it being run in a way that doesn't disrupt the current structure. So like house pricing, for example, everyone is terrified of affecting house prices. Like the obvious solution to a lot of Britain's problems is to build a lot more houses.
Yeah.
And that's going to obviously threaten the value of the existing houses, so that doesn't happen.
And the mechanism by which it doesn't happen is the planning system, which is an offshoot of the legal system.
Yeah.
And I think here you can see this kind of nexus of factional cooperation.
Yeah, because all the people running the planning system, the people running the legal system, the people owning the houses,
are
broadly the same,
Yeah, they're broadly the same people. They come from the same... They hold the same values. They can perceive, even if they don't consciously do so every day, they can perceive their shared interests. And so while it's not always coordinated, because they share the same interests, their actions end up being effectively coordinated to maintain the status quo.
Yeah. So I guess my one question here, because this sounds plausible, the question is whether it's useful, is has there been a time in British history where this faction has not held the power? I guess it would have been the aristocrats initially, and then that switched over to the middle class. But like since the last 300 years,
I think it's a valid point to say that in almost all times, at all places, it is usually the section of the population that holds the majority of the wealth, whether that's in property or land or whatever,
or titles,
that really does wield. That makes up, supplies the oligarchy with its
numbers. Okay, so actually it's quite rare for there to be a shock, and Caesarians were such a shock.
Yes, and when it does happen, we call it a revolution.
Yeah, that's it is something actually quite extreme and rare.
It's very extreme, where the ruling interests of property and land or whatever are actually overthrown and broken. It's very rare. But what Syme would be saying is that what happens is that property and land is redistributed amongst the successful factions.
Yeah, who then become...
Who then become...
The Optimates.
The Optimates, exactly right, yeah. And they cloak themselves in the political slogans of their defeated enemies in order to do so. So even when a revolution occurs, it can happen in the name of the plebeians or the dispossessed or whatever, but really it's just one gang taking over the oligarchy and redistributing the property and wealth in its own favour. And I think that, you know, when you look at, say, Russian history, one can make a compelling case that's
well,
true.
I mean, yeah, is there a revolution that doesn't follow that pattern?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. You're the historian.
Or any coup, or... Yeah.
But to
and I guess the closest you can say is the communist revolution, because the idea is you are now communist. And so it wasn't so straightforwardly controlled by... Well, it was absolutely controlled by bureaucracy. I guess, yeah, the source of power itself shifted away from landowning to controlling process.
Yeah, controlling sort of production.
Yeah.
But I mean, so yes, that's an interesting one, isn't it? But I formulated my definition quite carefully to say that it's the people that control the wealth, whether that wealth is in property or land. So if the wealth
still counts because the notion of wealth production had changed.
Exactly. Yeah. So the communists is an interesting one because they, of course, forced through that economic shift.
Yeah.
But you can see that as part of the process of taking over the oligarchy is that you shift where the wealth is into your favour in order to then have it for yourself. Returning to the UK and its current condition, what does this tell us about the UK and its current condition? Well, I actually think it's quite instructive. I think it's quite revealing.
Are you proposing that we need a revolution, but then also that revolution is futile because we'll end up in the same place again?
It's not that property and wealth can never be redistributed, and it's not that societies can't change themselves meaningfully to become better. I think they clearly can.
Mm.
And I think that one of the ways in which they do this is that they happen upon systems whereby the wealth or the property or the land or whatever can be distributed among a greater segment of the population. So in other words, you broaden the faction that supplies the oligarchy.
Yeah, I mean, you say through different distribution. I say it's through increasing the amount of wealth. Like as the whole country gets richer, everyone gets richer, so more people have a stake. More people become landowners.
Yes, I don't think we need to. I think the emphasis whichever emphasis you choose to put on there, I don't think we're talking about anything meaningfully different. I suppose that when you look at the 18th century, and almost all of the wealth is concentrated in a few landowners, and then you look at say the early 20th century, where it's starting to become the way you're starting to, you know, the emergence of the middle class is really happening. So it's late 19th century, I suppose, with the emergence of the bourgeoisie and stuff. Is that just that there's more wealth to go around, or is that a new type of wealth that's then bringing a new segment of the population into that vested interest faction?
Yeah, I mean, a bit of both, because undoubtedly we were all getting richer, but also where does money come from? Well, you're no longer rich because you own lots of land. You're rich because you own a factory.
Yeah, so the economy has changed such that more of the population can participate.
Well, essentially, labour becomes more valuable relative to assets.
Right.
And so everyone can generate wealth rather than just the people who own the assets.
Okay. So that isn't just us getting richer. That's not just the amount of value in the economy changing. That is the economy itself changing. Is in the mechanisms of the economy. Yeah.
Both are changing,
yeah. So I think that, you know, economic shifts, which ultimately rely on technological shifts, can improve things because they bring more people into the ruling faction. And then when you get enough people with vested interests, what you get is something like the sense of a united national front.
Yeah, which actually, it brings back to my point, there is a difference between amount of wealth increasing and how it's distributed changing. Because if the amount of wealth is increasing, you can have people getting wealthier, but it's not a zero-sum game. It's not by taking money from the richest.
Mm.
It's by everyone getting richer. And so you're not redistributing. You're not taking from some to build up others.
Mm.
It's everyone's getting built up.
Yeah.
And so that means that you're going to be much more unified because you're not having to screw some people over to benefit others.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, there's some finessing you'd have to think about, well, the relative wealth, where in the ideal situation, the difference between the wealthiest and the poorest narrows, but not through redistribution.
Do you think that makes a difference?
I don't know. I think
it's absolute wealth that's the important bit here.
I would agree from the perspective of what actually matters, but from the perspective of building a political coalition in which everyone has a sense of being on the same team.
Okay, yeah. And that's a good point because, yeah, even the poorest in the UK now have an iPhone.
Yeah.
Which would be unimaginable for even the richest 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So there's some finessing to do there, but I think that we agree on the basic points.
Yeah.
So, and I think that this underlies the theory that Thatcher kind of articulated when she talks about I'm sure she wasn't the first to talk about it, but I always associate this with Thatcher, when she talks about a property-owning democracy.
Yeah, there's conscious effort to get everyone owning a house.
Yeah, and I think that the underlying dynamic behind that or underneath it is that the more people own a house, the more people that own property, the more people there are in the governing faction.
Mm.
And if the governing faction can kind of supervene across more or less the whole nation...
Yeah, if it could cover 100% of the country.
Yeah, then that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because you then no longer have a situation where... sort of an exploitative situation of a narrow faction dominating the state in its own interests. Everyone's
aligned.
Everyone's dominating the state in their own interests. Brilliant. That's the definition of the perfect situation for a modern nation.
Yeah.
So what
sadly.
What went wrong? Yeah, what has gone wrong? Well, has the state been captured by a narrower faction since those kind of those optimistic days where there was an idea that we could build a property-owning democracy in which everyone had a share?
Or have we got poorer?
Well, have we got poorer? I don't know. That's an empirical question, isn't it? That's an empirical question.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't got poorer. Have we got poorer relative to other countries? Yes. Have we got poorer in an absolute sense? No.
Yeah.
It depends what you mean.
So what did go wrong? So why doesn't everyone own a house? We ended up with a government that believed in a bigger state, and so things like social housing were more encouraged or renting.
I don't know. I think that what happened is that the governing oligarchy didn't really follow through on its promise to admit everyone, because by admitting everyone you dilute the value that you have or the power that you have of being among the narrow group that controls the state. So let's put this in concrete terms, right? You say you're a property owner, you're wealthy, you have a pension, you have assets, you have, you know, an income, you care about interest rates. You are clearly going to vote for a government that provides stability, both for the value of your assets and your income.
Mm.
So a government that's promising to build an estate of houses in the neighbouring fields, that's going to directly going to reduce the value of your house.
Yeah.
So you're not going to vote for that. And also, it would mean that there's more pressure on sort of services and resources in your local area. You don't want that. And So you don't want that to happen.
So you've presented quite an excitingly new narrative where Thatcher was the one doing the redistribution, and then it was in the 90s where her vision for more equal society was destroyed.
Yeah. But I don't think it happened by sort of conscious central direction. Mm. I think that the property classes asserted their power through all of the organs of the modern British state, both at the local level and at the national level.
Yeah, yeah. If you want to get elected, you promise that there'll be no new houses being built in this area.
Yeah.
That happens at a council level, at an MP level, government level. Yeah.
And you know, there are many different sort of political slogans now that you can use to make sure this happens without necessarily admitting that you're doing it. You can talk about, you know, the value of the natural, the sort of the nature in the local area, preserving the green belt.
Was it mineral neutrality? Yeah, well, what's that one where you've got to keep the minerals neutral or something?
Oh, I don't know.
So some other environmental regulation.
Yeah.
Newts.
Newts and badgers and all kinds of things. And, like, I don't want to be wholly cynical about those things because some people really believe in them, and I, for one, think that, you know, it's a good thing to preserve biodiversity and the countryside. Mm. You know, on its own terms, yeah, brilliant. That's a good thing to do. But I think we'd be being very dishonest with ourselves if we didn't admit that these things have become political tools for the propertied classes. I'm going to call them the propertied class, the propertied and bureaucratic
faction. The optimates
to maintain their wealth and power.
Yeah, because all the environmental stuff is normally pushed by the richest in society.
Well, of course it is. Because it serves their interests.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that interest, I think those interests, you really, really can boil them down to the value of property and the preservation of the value of assets.
Yeah. In particular, house prices.
In particular, house prices.
Because that's what most automates have. They probably don't have other investments, really. They probably don't have much cash. Probably not many shares, but they do have a house.
Yeah.
In which almost all their wealth is stored.
Mm. Yeah. And so I think that this is what is really at the heart of the inertia in the modern British state, is that the state has been wholly captured by this faction at every level.
Yeah.
And the Tories and Labour, they are part of the same faction. They're not meaningfully politically different.
No.
And I think that
remarkably similar.
the vociferousness of the sort of the calumny that they direct at each other is directly sort of inversely proportional to the actual distance between their policies. And I don't think that's random or unexpected.
No, I think that pops up in quite a few walks of life.
Yeah, you know, the more similar you are, the more vociferously you have to protest that you're completely different.
Yeah,
and hence, you know, Labour's cries that the Tories are sort of intrinsically cruel and wicked when they cut anything, but Labour is sort of far-sighted and sensible when it cuts anything.
Yeah,
you know, vice versa with the Tories, and sort of Labour is this incredibly sort of reckless, statist, frivolous party with money, but you know that's being. And then the Tories will go and sort of plough $400 billion into lockdown policies and things like that. So you know, they really are just the same faction tossing political slogans at each other in order to compete for the top spots in the oligarchy in sort of 10-year cycles. But there is, I think, there is a small faction of the Tory Party that is not actually part of the same faction quite, and I think that it's that what the BBC would call the far right of the Tory party. It's the kind of caucus that I suppose is sort of represented by Kemi Badenoch now, that sort of merges into those kind of more reform tendencies. Boris Johnson managed to co-opt this faction quite well and build a sort of a broader church around it. And I think that the big thing that has happened in modern British political history, which was not the intention of this ruling faction, the optimates, is the Brexit referendum.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a disruption to the comfortable status quo.
Exactly. And I think that when you look at it in these terms, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because what followed the Brexit vote was quite an astonishing demonstration of power.
Yeah, a massive, massive backlash from the ruling faction. At every possible level.
Yeah, and across every possible medium.
And using every all of institution. Their, using all of the tools they have at their disposal.
Yeah.
Disposal. Law, the media, the bureaucracy, everything was thrown at it. Yeah. Yeah. But and you know, people seek to understand Brexit, and they say, "Well, how did this happen? Why did this happen? It doesn't make any sense." You know, we gave them all of these economic arguments. You know, we gave them all of these that showed that it's really in their interest to vote against Brexit, not understanding that people sensed the opportunity to fracture the grip of the ruling oligarchy,
the optimates,
and they took it. And even if they didn't quite, even if they are not quite able to articulate that themselves, I do think that's what.
Yeah, that is a very compelling narrative.
Mm.
But it does mean you're kind of lining up Octavianus and Nigel Farage in similar roles.
Or Trump. Yeah, I think absolutely. But the thing with Octavianus is that he was an incredibly sophisticated and canny politician. Who was able to... the other thing about him is that... Syme calls him a cold and mature terrorist.
Nice.
You know, he yeah.
Yeah, you do wish that Nigel Farage had that extra level to him.
Well, you do and you don't. Yeah,
well, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting if he did.
You know, the thing about Octavian is that the state control had broken down to the extent that private armies are being raised all over the place and it's just carnage. Raising a private army in modern Britain would be an interesting challenge. A short-lived one, I think.
I don't know. I mean, who'd stop you?
I think that you're underestimating the resolve in that governing oligarchy when push comes to shove.
Okay, but like, how many people with rifles would you have to get together for the police to not be able to deal with you?
Yeah,
they're calling. It's not a large number.
They're calling the army.
Yeah, except there's quite a lot of overlap between the army and the people who would be in this group.
Yeah, but the army would follow orders. I suppose that actually gets to the heart of the difference is that the army no longer had loyalty to the political slogans and organs of the ruling oligarchy. And that's why Octavian was able to break its grip.
Hmm.
But I think that, yeah, so that monopoly of violence is really important.
Yeah, but I mean, the army is really not aligned with the optimates.
No, but it is within... The army has a very, very strong tradition that it should follow orders of its political leaders.
But you're relying there on a tradition rather than their own self-interest.
I think that, and I'm not advocating this, but I think that if you wanted to co-opt the British Army as a tool for revolution, you would have to cloak yourself in monarchist language. Because the army obviously swears its oath to the monarch and their legal heirs and successors.
Yeah.
And I think that you'd have to co-opt, first of all, the sentiments, the political sentiments and ethical sentiments of the leadership of the army. And I think that would be the way to do it. So you would have to present them with a narrative that the government, the civilian government, was in some way treasonous to the king. Mm. And I think if you did that and you did it convincingly and you had credibility, I think that's the only thing that would shift them against the civilian government.
Yeah, I see you haven't thought about it this much.
No, I haven't. But I think, you know, if you had someone like Jeremy Corbyn come in...
That would have been an interesting interface.
You know, and I'm not the only person to speculate about this. I mean, Labour politicians themselves have written books about coups led by the army if there were to be a truly left-wing leader.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. But I think that while the governing oligarchy has a monopoly of violence through the armed forces in a country, they can't be shaken. They can't be removed.
Yeah, and yeah, your mention of needing monarchy, you need legitimacy to be able to overthrow the government.
Yeah.
And Octavian manufactured that legitimacy by...
Well, he did
it as a restoration of what had been before.
Exactly, yeah. And you need a situation where it's actually genuinely not clear where legitimacy lies.
Yeah.
Because that was true in the breakdown of the Republic. It became genuinely unclear. does legitimacy lie with the consuls? Does it lie with the Senate? Does it lie with, you know, the duty of to avenge one's father? You know, where is legitimacy? And so you need a situation where that's ambiguous as well. I think. So yeah, what do you think of that?
No, I like it. Yeah, it's interesting. You expect the narratives to change over time. You know, how people write about historical events. It is interesting that this one written in 1939 feels fresher or more relevant to today than a lot of the history books about the same period written more recently.
Yeah. One interesting revolution that this reminds me, actually, you just reminded me, because I was just thinking, you just reminded me about Tom Holland's Dominion. As something that's quite fun that's been written recently and offers a sort of novel take.
Yeah.
I think you could make an argument that one successful revolution that was carried out in history without the use of armed force per se, but that genuinely did, that wasn't just about taking over the ownership of property or land or whatever, is the religious revolutions that have occurred. Particularly, you know, the spread of Christianity in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries AD. Maybe the rise of Islam in the Near East. Maybe the revolution in the 11th century in the church, the way the church sort of organized itself in relation to the laity. I don't know, what do you think of that? Do you think you can think of those as revolutions?
Yeah, I mean, the Islamic ones, there's a definite change in who own the property, because the invading Muslim armies own the property now.
Yeah. Okay, so that one...
That one's out. But, yeah.
It's interesting that you can cloak... You can use a way of getting legitimacy... Another way that you can cloak this process in legitimacy is using religious language.
Yeah. So, yeah, Christianization.
I mean, obviously, the church ends up being incredibly wealthy, and actually the church ends up being effectively the ruling authority in many lands.
But I think that came later, didn't it?
It did, yeah. That's sort of in the 9th century.
Yeah, because that's when the church clearly became the source of power, the source of wealth. And so, your optimates,
all the
sociopaths would switch across to that rather than whatever else they could have done. But in the early days...
I mean, in the early days, Christianity seems to me to be an ideology that's quite consciously set against property.
Mm.
I mean, we all know the famous quotations, you know, it's easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. And, you know, how should I follow you, Lord? I should sell all your possessions or how should I get to heaven, Lord? You should sell all your possessions and follow me.
Mm.
So that's obviously a very... Jesus himself as a figure seems to have been a revolutionary in the sense of saying that property is evil, in a sense.
Yeah, I wouldn't go quite that far, but yeah, in general.
Mm.
Yeah, you're renouncing the importance of worldly status and goods.
Yeah, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's.
Yeah, it's not what's important, actually. What's important is... Jesus. So
ideas.
And, we mentioned religion, but other ideas come across. And while eventually the ruling idea will attract the optimates, initially that's not what's happening.
Well, I wonder whether the eternal appeal, the appeal of Christianity was such that it gave people an alternative hierarchy by which to judge themselves.
Yeah, so it's not just the rat race.
Mm.
You can attain spiritual heights as well as material heights.
Yeah.
Equally as valid.
And that being at the bottom of the material hierarchy gives you status in the spiritual hierarchy. I think that is one of the killer innovations of Christianity when we think about it in a purely cynical sense. Because that means that you've got a huge pool of people to whom there is no other compelling offer is being made by...
Yeah, you're giving dignity to the vast masses who toil in the fields.
Yeah. Yeah. And the great thing about it is that you can do that without threatening the existing hierarchy too much. Because you render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, so you say, well, that hierarchy still exists.
Yes, you ended up with actually two hierarchies for a lot of European history.
Yeah.
You had the church hierarchy and then the monarchical one.
And it,
they were often in conflict, but they were actually quite a good counterbalance to each other, and you could say that's why Europe took off.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things that's happened now is that second hierarchy is withered and died.
Mm.
And I wonder whether that is another big factor in why there is a sense of malaise in the West. I mean, that's not an original insight, but it's a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, but both from a kind of spiritual point of view, in that people aren't living rich spiritual lives at the moment. They're just chasing status and wealth.
Mm.
But also from the fact that, yeah, there's only one path to prestige and success.
Mm.
Or what feels like prestige. You know, it feels weird to use those words when you're talking of the spiritual.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you're now presented with one path where there used to be more paths.
Yeah. And, you see this kind of ever more fanatical competition amongst the middle classes in every...
Yeah.
In every economic realm.
And all on the same path. They're all playing a zero-sum game.
And they're not really trying to produce wealth. They're trying to safeguard it.
Yeah.
And grab it for themselves rather than produce it.
Yeah.
And that's that's a massive generalisation. But
but it is zero-sum thinking. No one's thinking about expanding the pie. They're just thinking about expanding their slice of the pie.
Very few people are thinking about expanding the pie. In the middle classes, I would say. It's more about tapping into a rich supply of the pie through the professions, usually. That is the concern.
Yeah.
And I think it's that bureaucratic mindset of, I need this position so that I'm entitled to this much of the resources.
Yeah. And then, the resources come from the position rather than your actual production.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think that is very symptomatic of the current ethos of the ruling faction in the UK. And it is that is sapping the sort of the economic energy of the country.
Yeah, so focus on material wealth, but not even doing it well.
So focus on it purely through the lens of one's personal status and membership of the ruling faction, which is why people get so, they get so wildly competitive about getting their offspring into, universities and graduate schemes and all these things, because what they're competing for is nothing less than membership of the ruling class or the ruling faction. And they know that deep in their bones, even if they're not quite able to say. And the astonishing irony of it is that all of this is cloaked in language that would suggest that they're doing the complete opposite. So they will, almost all of the middle classes will talk about equity, inclusion, tolerance, inclusivity, diversity, and yet their actions are pointing in an entirely different direction, in my view.
Yeah, well, what all these buzzwords mean is more bureaucracy to shore up the established interests.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be overly cynical about it. I think that, there is, obviously society is better now, I would say, to be in terms of its sort of, to be different types of people and so forth, and that's a good thing. But again, we have to be aware that
we just said that the problem is we've actually removed, in a very real sense, the ability for different sorts of people to do well in different ways by removing the ridges pole from society and focusing only on the material wealth pole.
Yes.
And so you're actually reducing their diversity by reducing the diversity of win conditions. And so, you can be whatever colour you want, but so long as you're aiming at the same target.
I think you could also be cynical in that it allows the property classes and the governing faction to control the terms upon which outsiders enter the faction.
Mm.
So, if you are coming from outside because of your race, your language, your ethnic origin, your sexuality, whatever, it allows the faction as it is to control the way in which.
Yeah, the check, because now it's not fully on merit now.
No. Yeah.
There are other factors.
So, you know, again, I don't want to be wholly cynical about it, but I think what Syme would say is that you should always look at the political slogans, the catchwords, the buzzwords of the day as tools for the governing faction to buttress its own power. That is what he is. That is one of his claims. And I think that, you know, you can... it's certainly a fertile area of thought.
There's a lot there.
There's a lot there. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, there we go. There's my thoughts.
That's excellent. Yeah. Wisdom from 1939.
Wisdom from 1939.
As fresh as if it was written yesterday.
He also writes like Tacitus, which is great. So it's definitely... He's self-consciously, I think, sort of mimics Tacitus's extremely direct and laconic almost.
Does he make up long speeches?
No, but he does like, he's a very big fan of the short, almost ungrammatical statement that's very memorable. What's one? Sulla found he couldn't abolish his own example. You know, just the little things like that, and that is sort of, you know, quite pithy and on the money.
Or maybe I will read it.
I think it's a good one to read. It's quite dense sometimes. There's long lists of Roman names.
But you can skip that.
Yeah, you can skip that, yeah. And the his chapters on the actual political events, you know, the narrative, are actually quite thrilling. You really get a sense of the chaos and danger of the revolutionary period. It would have been quite an intense time to be alive, I think.
It would have been.
But almost no one survived. I mean, that's what's really interesting about the revolutionary period, is that from the leaders, almost none survived. The people who did survive were the legionaries, which is interesting.
There's a lesson there.
There is a massive lesson there. Yeah. The revolutionary period in which is one in which things are inverted. Yeah. Well, very good.
Very good.
Until next time.